soon found he was a real good horse for pulling logs out from among the stumps and brush without my touching a line. I would walk into the brush to the log I wanted with my axe, clearing a narrow path as I went, Prince following faithfully behind. On reaching the log, I would step behind him, pick up his single tree or evener with the chain attached, and on command he would turn around. I would hook the chain to the log and tell him to go. He would then backtrack to the skidway, pulling the log behind him. If the log got stuck on a stump, he would stop, turn sharp right or left angle, pull the log clear of the stump, and then return to his tracks and carry on. All the time I was walking in the good path he had made. Prince and I piled up logs for several houses that year, and as you see, I have never forgotten him. And so ends another little story in among my many. And now we come to part four in my series of stories of my early days in the Peace River block. In the first three parts, I tell of some of my journey here, my reasons for staying, and the first few weeks in a crude cabin on the banks of Bear Creek. I buy a horse, Prince, and Alex Salo gets a broken tooth from a misadventure with said horse. I'll call this part my trip to the dentist. Long before daylight the next morning, Alec and I were up. Prince was fed and watered. We had our breakfast, hitched Prince to the jumper, and started off. We had no tracks on the trail for the first 4 or 5 miles, and a windstorm had blown down a few dead poplar trees, so Alec walked ahead, throwing these out of the way. The snow was about a foot deep, which made our heavy jumper quite heavy for Prince to pull, so I walked behind the jumper. After 3 or 4 miles, we joined up with some other sleigh tracks, which made the going much easier for Prince, and Alec and I jumped onto our sled for a little rest. By the time we got to the Peace River, the road was quite good, and the river was frozen over, so no trouble there. However, we were faced with a long uphill grade from the bottom of the river to within 3/4 of a mile of Rolla. That sled was heavy, and we could not make very good time. Finally, shortly after 11 a.m., we had Prince eating oat bundles in Ole Grotime's livery barn in Rolla. He had been bulling steadily for almost 4 hours and was in need of a rest and refreshment. Alec and I went to Mrs. Forbes for dinner and to inquire about where we could find a dentist. Mrs. Forbes thought there was one in Pouce Coupee. So being a little disappointed at not finding one in Rolla, we hitched up Prince and started for Pouce Coupee. The road was good and hard here. The day was sunny for January, and Prince jogged right along down through the Saskatoon Creek and up the other side, down through Dawson Creek and up the other side. And about 2 hours later, we were in Pouce Coupee. Yes, they said, there is a dentist calls here once a week, but his home is in Dawson Creek, and there you will find him. After getting directions on how to get to Dawson Creek, I turned Prince around, and back north I went for 2 miles, then west 5, then north 1, then west about a half mile, and just as the sun was setting, Rizback's hotel and livery barn and the co-op store came in view on the banks of South Dawson Creek, where Canalta Park is now. Putting the horse in the barn, Alec and I started out to find the dentist. We found him in the hotel, and he said he would look after Alec first thing in the morning. Rizback's hotel was full up, as far as beds were concerned, but they fed us the usual big supper around the table. Alec and I had decided we would have to sit out the night in a couple of the chairs in the waiting room, but about 10 o'clock we looked up to see a mattress come tumbling down the stairs and a whole lot of blankets and pillows after it. There, said Mr. Rizback, make that up into a bed on the floor here. It will be better than sleeping in a chair. We lost no time in fixing up our bed, and soon I was fast asleep for my first night in Dawson Creek. When I went to pay Mr. Rizback for our supper and breakfast and the horse's stall, he would take nothing for the bed. Once again, the hospitality of the North shone through. The dentist was a Dr. Cavill. His home was in a two-room house a little west of the creek. I think about where there is a gateway into a pasture field now. He had told us to come over about 9 in the morning, so about that time we walked over the front room of the house Dr. Campbell used as his office, with his chair, a drill operated by foot power, and cupboards with his instruments in them. In the back room was a small table, a four-legged cook stove, wood of course, and his bed, which he had just gotten out of. He put Alec in the dentist's chair, took a look at Alec's tooth, and seeing that he had next to no English, said to me, "I'll have to put a gold cap on it. I guess I better sterilize some of these instruments." And gathering up a handful or two, he took them out to the cook stove, where he had dumped his supper dishes into a dishpan sitting on the back of the stove. He threw the instruments in with the dishes, poured a couple of pots of water taken from a barrel in the corner, stoked up the fire, and sat down and talked with me till the water came to a boil. Getting a tray from his office and using a pair of pliers, he fished his tools out of the boiling water, set them on the tray, and was ready for business. Off the shelf he took a bottle that looked as if it had a few grains of sand in it. "That's gold," he said to me, and taking a small bit of it in the hollow of his hand, and then placing it on a small anvil, proceeded to pound it out very flat and thin with a hammer. When he had it thin enough to suit him, he brought some steel casts out of men's teeth out of another drawer, searched around till he found a tooth that would have looked like Alec's if Alec had all his teeth there. Placing the little gold sheet on the steel tooth, he proceeded to mold it around the pattern with his little hammer. The bottom or open end was a little jagged around the edges, so taking a pair of snips, he smoothed this off, putting the pieces back in the bottle. He then worked on Alec's tooth a little and slipped the tooth he had made over Alec's broken one. A look of immense relief spread over Alec's face. He had no more pain, I could plainly see. "That will be $10 if you have it," said Dr. Campbell, and went back to his other room to get his breakfast. Alec didn't have $10, but I had, so I gave it to the doctor. Alec and I got my horse, and after inquiring the best road back to Rolla, we started. I remember we drove out a country road over what is now 17th Street. We had good going all the way to Rolla. Fed and watered Prince in Ole Grotime's barn again, had our dinner at Mrs. Forbes, and about 6 at night was back in our cabin on the banks of Bear Creek. I lost track of Alec in a year or two, but so far as I know, that tooth never gave him a moment's trouble. I heard that he had died sometime in the early 60s, but do not know if he still had the tooth. I believe I have a little time left yet on this tape, so I'm going to copy a bit of a letter written to me by Shirley Huff, a niece of mine, who is writing a sort of a biography of my mother's. I am putting this in because I just happened to come across it this afternoon while searching through my desk drawer. I hope all mothers, young or old, who hear this will enjoy it. Shirley writes, "I am sending you a poem written by your mother on September the 9th, 1902. It's in her own handwriting and dedicated to you." End of quote. I would be just about 9 months old at that time. Here is the poem. Bertie has gone to dreamland to see what he can see, and when he comes back in the morning, he'll tell it all to me. He'll hear the birdies warble and see the lovely flowers. He'll hear the waters rippling and rest neath shady bowers. In the morn he'll shake with laughter that fills our heart with joy. For why should sorrow enter when playing with our boy? And that's about all for this time. This is Bert Moffett. And here comes the fifth of my little series of anecdotes in my stories of the early days in the Peace River. So far I have confined these stories in a space and time from October 1928 to early in January 1929. In my last story I tell of taking Alex Saylor to a dentist in the little hamlet of Dawson Creek. This time I'll go on about a trip out to a doctor at Rolla. Here's the story. Later in the winter, I traded Prince, my skidding horse, for Bubbles. Prince's sex was against him. Also, I felt I could get a horse that could go faster on the road than Prince. Bubbles looked to be such a mare. She was young and sound, had a kind eye in her head, and she was the proper sex to raise me colts, to work my land in the years to come. Jim McFarlane also had Bubbles. In fact, he was Bubbles the mare. In fact, he was continually trading horses, much as the car salesmen do now with cars. I had to give Jim Prince and $20 to get Bubbles. I also had to drive Prince over to Jim's and there pick up Bubbles. Jim said she was broken to harness, but had never been rode or driven single. While transferring Prince's harness to Bubbles, I came to the conclusion that Bubbles knew very little about harness. She was terrified when I dropped it on her. "Oh, oh," I said to myself, "Jim has been a little careless with the truth when he said Bubbles was used to the harness." Jim was not at home the day I arrived. I had hoped to get a little help from him hitching Bubbles to my jumper. As he was not there, I located four poplar trees in the yard that were sitting just right, and using other poles, built a two-sided stall about 2 feet by 10 feet. In this, I tied Bubbles. She did answer the halter real well. I then took another pole, and using ropes to tie it, I squeezed her in her two-sided stall. This grounded her quite effectively, without hurting her in any way. I then pulled the shafts of the jumper on each side of her, fastened them good to the surcingle, and hooked up the tugs. I then cast loose the pole that was holding her and got into the jumper and gathered up the lines. She stood there a minute or two, thinking she was still tied up solid, but she soon found she could push the shafts a little sideways and thus clear the front of her stall. I shook the lines a little bit, and she bounded out of there just like a bucking horse coming out of the chutes of a rodeo. After about a half a mile, she settled down to a good fast trot, and about a half an hour later, we were in Rolla. I had a real good horse, but man, did she ever need watching. I tied her to a post, still hitched to the jumper, while I was in Rolla. After getting a few groceries, I untied her and attempted to leave Rolla. Bubbles wanted to go west. I wanted to go east. She had another bucking streak, and we compromised by circling around half the backyards in Rolla. I got her headed east just as somebody's woodpile loomed up in front of us, so over it we went. A good sized block of wood became wedged under the jumper, and with me and the jumper teetering on top of the block of wood, Bubbles took us out of town east at a good fast gallop. The pounding of the block of wood on the road made an unholy noise, scaring the wits out of poor Bubbles, and we were almost out as far as the graveyard, a half mile, before I got her slowed down enough that I could hop out and thus free the wood from under the jumper. We made it back to our cabin on Bear Creek in about 2 hours, almost twice as fast as Prince could have done it. I was real proud of my mare, considering the fact that this was all completely new to her. She was not even unduly warm, although of course she was sweating a little. I let her cool off in my barn a little before I watered her. But this is about all the extra attention she needed. Waiting for me in the cabin was a Mr. Eli Tikkanen, who with his wife and two little girls and a boy lived 3 miles west of me. He was a Finlander with very little English at that time. However, by using Walter as an interpreter, I found that Eli wanted to hire my horse and jumper so that he could take his oldest little girl, Ann, into Rolla to see the doctor. I readily agreed, but stipulated that I had to go along to drive my new mare. Old Prince would have been fine for Eli to learn to drive, but Bubbles was no horse for an amateur. This took some explaining, especially as Walter, the Finn in our house, was not working too hard at his part of the explaining. Anyway, before daylight the next morning, I had Bubbles in front of Eli's door, and we loaded Ann in. She was a beautiful girl, about 7 years old, with long, honey-colored hair. Owing to the language difficulties, I never did find out what was the matter with her. Eli was quite concerned about keeping her warm, and he wrapped her well in two or three of their own quilts. Bubbles was still quite skittish, but learning more and more how to handle herself in the awkward shafts of the jumper. For the most part, she jogged along quite good. However, I had to watch quite closely, as now and then she would take a notion to turn square around. Like the old strawberry roan, she could turn on a dime and give you some change. That is, she could if she had not been hampered by those terrible shafts and the jumper. I bet she hated it. Her burning desire was to get out of where she was and get somewhere else, and this, of course, is what I liked about her. As the closest way to Rolla from Eli's was by way of Hackett's Crossing, we used that trail. Now, at that time, the trail was not very good on the east side of the river. West side, too, for that matter. The steep banks on the east side were causing me some worry, as there was one or two steep hills where we would practically have to slide down, and I was afraid Bubbles would not know how to hold back her heavy load of two men and a girl, plus the jumper. So when we got to the top of the hill, I got out and asked Eli to get out. Eli and I were no sooner out than I saw my mistake. My feet slipped from under me on the steep grade, and I almost lost control of Bubbles, who started kicking and bucking and running down that crooked steep hill with renewed vigor, me still hanging on to the reins, but sliding along on my fanny and searching desperately with my feet for some sort of a toehold so that I could apply some pressure to the reins. I was terrified. There was sick little beautiful blonde-haired Annie sitting all bundled up in that sled with a crazy bronc almost running wild down that awful hill. I decided something had to be done quickly. So with the last bit of control I had, I steered Bubbles between two trees on the side of the road. The shafts passed through, but as I had hoped, the front of the jumper banged smack into one of the trees, and the single tree broke, and away went Bubbles down the hill, with the high-flying tugs with a bit of single tree attached to each one of them, smacking her over the rear with every jump. Picking myself up, I turned to see Eli with Ann, a sobbing Ann, in his arms, and he was trying to comfort her through his own sobs. Taking off one mitt, he put out his hand to shake mine. "Good, good, good," he said, and by the tone of his voice, I knew he meant it. I had done the right thing by breaking the horse loose from the jumper. Well, Ann was safe, which was the most important consideration. But there we were out on that godforsaken hill with no horse. I had no idea where my horse would go to, as she certainly was not on home territory. And of course, Eli and I could not talk over a situation like this. We bundled Ann back into the jumper, then worked it back onto the trail, and the two of us getting between the shafts started on down the hill. Ann seemed to feel that we were much more reliable than any horse and soon started to laugh. We made quick time to the bottom of the hill, about a mile, and out onto the river. Signs of Bubbles passing were quite evident by virtue of the fact that those broken single tree ends took a gouge out of the snow whenever they hit the ground. On the flat on the other side of the river was a cluster of old cabins built by an oil well crew many years before, and in these cabins John Hodson and his wife and two girls were spending the winter. When we got close to the cabin, John came out to meet us. "Don't you think you should have a horse for that jumper?" he said. "By gosh, yes," I said. "Have you got one? I could have till I find mine." "Come on into the barn," he said. And there was Bubbles, munching oat bundles. John had heard her running down the hill and managed to catch her, and not knowing when someone would be along to claim her, had put her in his barn and fed her. "John, if you hear this, thank you once again." Mrs. Hodgson and the girls took Ann into the house. I took an axe and chopped down a willow tree that looked just about right. Eli took his hunting knife and whittled off the ends of this stick till we could drive the iron hooks from my broken single tree on, and there was another single tree. John had a brace and bit to bore a hole through the center and some hay wire to wrap around one of the shafts that was cracked a little, and we were ready to go. Bubbles was pretty frightened of the whole proceeding, but John was better with horses than I was and helped me hitch up, and we were soon on our way again. Now the long trip and the long steep climb out of the Moose River faced us. A Chinook had turned the road almost to ice, and poor Bubbles had a most difficult time standing up, let alone pulling, as she had no shoes with sharp cocks in them on her. However, with me out on her lead rope pulling her and Eli behind pushing on the jumper, we finally got to the top of the hill. I think this last experience convinced Bubbles that although I might be a madman, she and I had one thing in common: to get one place to another as quickly as we could. And from that time on, she seemed to trust me in whatever judgment I made, and was the gentle, willing, tough horse I knew her to be when I looked into her eyes in Jim McFarland's stable. Eli took Ann to a Dr. Simpson in Rolla. I fed Bubbles again in Ole Grotime's barn, had lunch at Mrs. Forbes, and then took Bubbles around to Ray Servant, the blacksmith, and asked him to put sharp shoes on her for me. "You here again?" he said. "I thought the way you ran that horse over the woodpile yesterday, you'd be dead before you got home." "You should have seen us today," I said. Ray, like most Frenchmen, was good with horses, and we actually had very little difficulty shoeing Bubbles. The sharp shoes and the icy road made a good combination, and soon Ann, Eli, and I were bouncing along on the way home. And within 2.5 or 3 hours, we were home. And now I think I'll stop. Thank you so much for listening. This is Bert Moffat. This is all the speeches I have prepared in this series. I see there's a little time left on this tape, and I would once again like to mention to those of you who are listening, I have made this especially for my sons and daughter, and will try to give one tape to each of you. I know that at the moment it may not be very interesting, but many have said that quite likely this, the last of the horse age as we know it, when horses were used as work methods of transportation, I should say, it was a common thing. And possibly your children or your children's children, if they still have cassette tapes, will be able to run this off and hear the voice of their own old grandpa talking to them. And so once again, I'm doing this for you. I wish it was better prepared. I find a complete amateur at this. I have gone to considerable trouble writing and rewriting these tapes to condense them to a certain extent and yet get in what I think is enough detail. And so here it is, for better or worse. I wish I was a professional, which I am not. And so goodbye again. This tape, incidentally, has been made in the second week in January of 1975. I have just gotten over a heart attack, which took me in November. And I find I am still having, at times, a little trouble with my voice yet. It seems to get husky very easily, and many times I have to stop and clear my throat or take a drink of water. And this also contributes to the poorness of this tape. So long for now. Grandpa Moffat.
Say, that's what I say.